Welcome to False Flag Weekly News, the weekly news show that tells you pretty much everything you really need to know about the craziness going on in the world today and specifically what happened during the past week. I'm Kevin Parrott with Jeremy Rothkuschel, and we are honoring the memory of Alan Hart and trying to follow in his illustrious footsteps. Alan Hart worked for the BBC, but he was a real journalist who called it the way he saw it, right up to and including hot-button topics like Zionism and even 9/11 truth. So, hey, Alan Hart, wherever you are now, and I would imagine a fairly high station of paradise for your courage, we're with you.
Yes, and I just want to say that I appreciated your interviews with him and giving him a platform to take his truth-telling to the next level. I remember listening to them as I was driving around delivering papers late at night, and they would bring me a sense of possibility for where the truth could take us. And I just loved his idea that if you want peace, then you need to put truth into the mix, of course. So it's truth, justice, peace, freedom. If our people are starved of knowledge, then our intention must be to feed them.
Hey, that's not beautifully put. You know, and Alan really did show that you can be a mainstream journalist. You know, you can be a talking head, pretty face, friend of Golda Meir, Yasser Arafat, Jimmy Carter, Victor Rothschild, on and on and on, and still stick to the truth. I wish there were more people in those positions like Alan, and, you know, maybe a couple of them, if they're watching today, will be inspired to come out. Well, Jeremy, let's move on to 9/11, which is kind of our linchpin issue here. You know, in terms of history, 9/11 was the turning point. The orchestrated turning point. And was it Saudi Arabia that orchestrated it? Well, that's what we're kind of hearing in court from some Ground Zero 9/11 family members, survivors. And that big court case is shaping up to be pretty interesting. The judge sounds like he's already leaning towards the Saudi point of view. What do you think, Jeremy?
This, of course, is related to the contention around the 28 pages and whether an investigation into the intelligence patsy side of the September 11th operation that links into, in large part, Saudi Arabia allowing their nationals to be blamed as patsies. But of course, that does not actually explain the actual physical operations that were actually killed these family members. Family. And so I think there's some issues here, and I would urge these family members to get further educated if they don't know what's actually going on with September 11th. And the woman here, Terry Strada, I've seen her on TV, and I don't get a sense that she is really after the truth. And she actually has a background at working at JP Morgan Chase, which doesn't say everything, but it's interesting. So I'd urge the Jersey girls, if they are of good faith and intent, to push the reality of what's been discovered about who actually killed their family members forward.
Well, I would too. And I would hope that they know this and that they're trying to use this Saudi connection as a way of prying the whole case back open. That's what people like Les Jamieson and Sander Hicks believe. And I hope they're right. Barry Kissin, another one who's working hard on that issue. You know, anything to pry this thing back open that works, I'm for it. I'm not sure this will. Next story, we have these cancers and strange illnesses killing off 9/11 first responders. Here we have another firefighter dead. Pretty huge numbers of cops and firefighters dead now. It's up to like 500 or something. Lots of rare cancers, some of which only show up with nuclear things. This is pancreatic cancer, which is nuclear related, but not necessarily so. Jeremy, your conclusions.
The nature of these cancers does point to some type of high energy weaponry, whether it's micro nuclear devices or what. But the police officers and the firefighters should be some of the key activists here in terms of getting to the truth of who killed their fellow first responders on the day of September 11th, but now who's responsible for their deaths a decade and a half later. And in a certain way, it reminds me of the Iraq war in relationship, not just to its impact on Iraqis, but also in terms of its impact on American soldiers. Thousands have been killed in the midst of it, but probably 100,000 have taken their lives in the wake of that.
Well, let me correct myself. It was actually about 300 New York cops and firefighters dead from 9/11 toxicity. But the number, if we include all the first responders, would be much, much higher. Well, next 9/11 related story, the Fresh Kills landfill, notorious for disposing of evidence. That's where the mob sent all of that molten, half-molten, Swiss cheese-looking steel from the towers to be either dumped in the ocean or supposedly put on a slow boat to China without anybody ever getting a chance to look at it. Only a tiny percentage of this steel ever got examined. And when it did, the New York Times told us that Building 7 steel frame members looked like Swiss cheese. They'd not only been massively molten, but they'd actually been evaporated by something that operated at a temperature far beyond office fires, probably far beyond nanothermite too. We're talking many, many, many thousands of degrees Fahrenheit. It's kind of a nuclear situation. It could be, or some other exotic weaponry, who knows? And the New York Times said this was the biggest mystery of 9/11. So now Fresh Kills, which everybody in New York knows is run by the mob, or was run by the mob with that ironic name, is going to become a memorial park.
I didn't think about the Fresh Kills really dark irony of this.
And yeah, human remains from 9/11 are all over the place there. And of course, human remains from mob killings, because everybody knows the garbage industry in New York is run by the mob. Fresh Kills landfill is their turf.
And spiritually, there is a real abhorrent cynicism in relationship to the building of these projects, whether it's the parks or the 9/11 memorial. And a lot of times you see the Israeli connection directly there, almost flaunting. In this case, the firm that's designing this park also, they flaunted in this article too, designed the Ariel Sharon Park in the hills east of Tel Aviv. Oh, so that gives you a sense of who is celebrating what potentially.
Maybe they should be sister parks, you know, the way they have sister cities, Ariel Sharon Park and Fresh Kills, because Ariel Sharon undoubtedly was involved in 9/11. He helped set it up by leading those stormtroopers into the Masjid al-Aqsa, the mosque in Jerusalem, in about 6 months before 9/11, setting off that intifada, which then 9/11 allowed them to utterly and completely crush, and even go so far as murdering Yasser Arafat, Edward Said, and other leaders of the Palestinian resistance. But let's move on to Korea for the moment, because that's where the next big 9/11 false flag event could set off the next huge clash of civilizations. I don't know about that, but it could be quite a nasty clash. This is not a drill, folks. Nuclear missiles are coming at us right this minute. So bend over, put your head between your legs, and kiss it goodbye. That's what people were being told on their cell phones and smartphones over in Hawaii this week. So Jeremy, it's kind of amazing that, you know, that nobody actually died from, you know, whatever, you know, jumping into the ocean or panicking or whatever. This is completely crazy. How did this happen?
Yeah, people were putting their family down and down, opening up manholes and putting them down in the sewer system to protect them. And this seems to be more than meets the eye. This doesn't look like a mistaken a button was pushed. And whether this was a drill of some sort or some type of provocation to amplify the budget, the defense budget in terms of Pacific Command, or whether this was actually an intercepted attack by some type of rogue sub shooting a missile at Hawaii, and it was actually taken down by people in the U.S. military actually following their oath to protect and defend the Constitution and the American people, it's not clear yet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's, you know, the I think the simplest, relatively innocent explanation here would be that this was a not a drill drill that the folks who put it out wanted to see what would happen in the event of a real warning. That's always, that's the simplest relatively innocent explanation, but there's a lot more, and we'll get to some of that. Here's Trump saying it was an exercise, admitting it was an exercise, but saying, no, it wasn't us. It wasn't the feds. It was just the state. Geez, so it's an exercise. What kind of exercise? Again, it could be a not drill drill. What really happened? What do people do when you tell them they're about to be blown up by a nuclear bomb? We need to find out so we can figure out how many casualties we're going to get when we hit North Korea. You think that might be it, Jeremy?
That would be the way to run an authentic drill, would be to pose it as an actual mistake of what would actually happen in the scenario that you're building. That could be, but there's also a sense that this is part of the strategy of tension that certain folks are using to build towards a scenario where some type of escalated military conflict in the Pacific theater, it becomes inevitable.
Well, purely a state exercise, as Trump says, there's no such thing, because we know the state governments are completely infiltrated and run by covert feds. Jesse Ventura told us when he took over as governor of Minnesota, the first thing that happened after he was sworn in was he was led downstairs to the basement under the state capitol, a secret room in the basement that he didn't know existed, where they sat him down, and a couple dozen people, mostly CIA, who are working state jobs undercover, but they're really CIA, proceeded to interrogate Jesse to find out how he won the governorship. So purely a state exercise in this case is obvious cover-up. But here's another part. Yeah, go ahead.
Increasingly also that in the post 9/11 world, with the rise of Homeland Security and the calls for harmonization, the fusion centers that have been set up for Homeland Security are in many ways a further amplification of that federalization of our state and local governments that you're talking about.
Absolutely. Well, here's the speculation that starts to get kind of out there that you mentioned earlier, Jeremy. This is Robert David Steele's public intelligence blog. And he's throwing out some scraps of information suggesting that there might have been an actual nuclear missile firing from an Israeli sub. Watch out for those Israeli subs. They've been blamed for all sorts of things, cutting information cables, firing a missile at the Pentagon on 9/11, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Hard to verify some of these things. These subs are rather quiet, and we never get a full transparent accounting. Is this plausible, Jeremy, or is this unlikely?
I think this is it's maybe unlikely, but it's quite plausible. And what's interesting is down in this write-up, there are anonymous scraps of information from locals in Hawaii who supposedly saw flash in the sky, were unable to record it, apparently. There's some background here to contend with in relationship to Israel's involvement in covert warfare in the Pacific theater. If you go back and look at Israeli security companies and their involvement potentially at Fukushima in terms of the 3/11 apparent attack. So, and then also there's a link to an article about the newest Israeli sub, the Dolphin 2 class delivered from Germany, is a key part in terms of the Israeli nuclear triad and their ability to threaten the world, as has been put forward by Martin Creveld, who said that the Samson option included potential missiles targeting European cities. So to provoke potential warfare in the Pacific theater is not beyond the scope of Israel or other actors.
Well, I know Gordon Duff over at Veterans Today, who we'll be mentioning a little bit later in terms of his article about Google being the great Satan, says that Israel had something to do with helping the North Koreans get a big nuclear program going quickly. And he thinks that Israel is playing a destabilizing role there for its own purposes. I don't know, but it does seem that this alarmism around nuclear issues and North Korean missiles coming at us, along with these drills happening over in Korea, represents a kind of a U.S. imperial pushback against the possibility of peace breaking out in Korea, which could lead to unification of a genuinely independent Korea, and then the U.S. and its bases and stuff would be kicked out. Right now, South Korea is a U.S. colony, North Korea is an angry U.S. adversary, and now the two Koreas are marching together at the next Olympics, if the Olympic Committee lets them, under the United Korea flag. The empire is panicking. Maybe that's why we're getting all of this nuclear alarmism.
Yes, and there clearly are people who understand that the diplomacy, the real power of diplomacy, is talking. That's and if you combine that with Alan Hart's insight about who was there in terms who understood the power of diplomacy and the problems of diplomacy and the limitations, if you insert then the truth into diplomacy, and we might relate back to a couple weeks ago when we talked about it might be a time for the United States to do an apology for its attack on North Korea and biological warfare and all of that. What would that do to decrease the tensions? And of course, North Korea is not an aggressive threat against the United States of America. It's always, you know, known that it's a hermit nation. It's scared of its own security.
So then what role does Trump play in all of this? In the next slide, we see that Trump actually personally, he has the power to send out emergency alerts to your cell phone, to everybody's cell phone. Wow. Will he be able to resist this power? I mean, the guy can't resist the tweeting button. He'll tweet just about any darn thing that comes through his head. And now he can send everybody in America an emergency alert on their cell phone. Just knowing Trump's psychology, I mean, how could he resist?
As long as he doesn't send dick pics through DM on Twitter, then
we'll get to that story in a minute. So yeah, you can wait with bated breath. But meanwhile, Japan also got one of these fake warnings. Once it could conceivably be some kind of weird snafu mistake, but twice, like within a couple of days apart, that's not a coincidence.
No, and again, this could fit into a coordinated regional drilling operations and or provocations.
So is this a lead up to another Korean War? We know there are various forces that might like that. People make money off these things. They can terrorize the people and bring in more government powers. Politicians like Trump, if he becomes the fearless macho leader of a nation at war with thousands of American servicemen dying over in Asia, suddenly his numbers might radically improve. There are all sorts of people who could gain from this. But if we actually have another Korean War, it might not go so well. It wouldn't be a surgical cakewalk. And this is a pretty good article from Politico, not necessarily always my favorite rag, that goes over the reasons that this really is not a good idea.
Yes, and this comes from a man, Van Jackson, who was part of the highest levels of actual military theoretical strategic planning about what to do in relationship to North Korea. But underlying all of this, of course, is the question of how did all of this begin? Why is there all of this tension? And what is the purpose of the imperial forces, in this case, aspects emanating out of some levels of the U.S. government, in relationship to utilizing North Korea as some type of asset, a sort of a geostrategic national asset to continue with a certain aggressive presence in the Pacific theater?
Well, Tulsi Gabbard, who is not my favorite politician, but she's definitely my favorite Islamophobe politician, because I don't know any better ones, is pointing out the obvious here. I mean, she's over in Hawaii. She's getting these alerts. Here comes the nuclear missile. Bend over and kiss it goodbye. And so that's adding to her reasons for questioning this whole scenario. And she points out that the U.S. preconditions on North Korea are making the talky-talky solution impossible.
even if there were just this less, a little bit less Islamophobic, a little bit less close to the Israel lobby, a woman in charge of, you know, State Department, or even took machine gun Haley's position. Can you imagine what the kind of difference of diplomatic effectiveness the United States would have?
Hey, I you know, trying to imagine, you know, cheering for an Islamophobe at the UN representing the United States, that's boggling my mind. But yeah, no, Tulsi Gabbard, she's not totally, you know, on the page of the forces of imperial idiocy. You know, she questions things every now and again. She questions Syria. So, you know, let's give credit where it's due. People can be right about one issue and wrong about others. And this, we shouldn't demonize people because, okay, she's an Islamophobe, so she's totally 100% evil. Not necessarily. Likewise with Zionists. You know, there are people who are pro-Israel Zionists who might be really good on a bunch of things. We have to take all these issues separately, and we should try to avoid the ad hominem approach that just demonizes an entire person, an entire culture, an entire race, ethnicity, religion, what have you, and tries to say that it's all wrong. The world is a lot more complicated than that.
And meanwhile, call her office in both Hawaii and D.C. and let them know about the neocon agenda and September 11th and Israel, and educate them, and maybe it will make its way up the ladder, or at least expose her to that.
Well, that's a great idea. You know, and a shout out to my friend Byron, who often does these phone calls to congressional offices and has some surprisingly productive results occasionally, talking about 9/11 with congressional staffers and things like that. More people should do that. Okay, let's move on to this Wormwood story. Errol Morris, the illustrious documentary maker who did The Thin Blue Line, which is a brilliant investigation of a Texas murder when the wrong guy got convicted. He also did a really interesting documentary on the gas chamber controversy at Auschwitz, in which, of course, Morris came down strongly on the side of Holocaust orthodoxy. But he's a brilliant filmmaker. And there's this new film out, Wormwood, which I haven't seen yet, that George Burchett here is telling us about. And it looks like Morris is exposing U.S. use of massive biological warfare, including plague, in the Korean War. And this is the topic of the book, This Must Be the Place. It's very well documented. And the U.S., of course, went through this phase of hysteria in which the many, many American fighter pilots and service people who'd been, you know, shot down and stuff and confessed to this were then, the official line was, these people were brainwashed. The Koreans have a Manchurian candidate technology. And the reason that all of these Americans are confessing to using biological warfare is because they've been brainwashed by the evil Koreans. Turns out that's BS. The reason they confessed is it was true. So this whole story could blow the Korean issue wide open and lead to the preconditions for a U.S. apology to North Korea and peacemaking and maybe Korean unification and a wind down of U.S. empire. And that would be a happy ending for the Korean situation.
Yes. And this again goes back maybe to the theme of the day in terms of Alan Hart and the power of the truth. And what you see here is the next generation of sons really working hard to get to the matter of the truth of what the truth was about their father and their father's death in the case of Frank Olson, or their father's truthful journalism in the case of Burchett. Mm-hmm. And it turns out that Wilfred Burchett actually also was the first journalist to cover Agent Orange, the use of Agent Orange in Vietnam, and was just in general a truth teller and vindicated these days. And Frank Olson, this makes a lot of sense in relationship to the Frank Olson story, which this article talks about how the CIA's favorite mode of liquidating, getting rid of somebody is to so-called drop them from a building or that type of thing by first hitting them in the head and then pushing them out. And it seemed at first that there was this whole LSD thing surrounding Olson, which was true because Olson was involved in MK Ultra. Ultra, Artichoke, I believe, too. And there are larger features to that. Go look at Gnostic Media and Jan Irvin's A Sense of MK Ultra, not just about LSD, but as the patterning of the entirety of 60s counterculture. And this makes a lot more sense that this was not just about covering up LSD experiments, but this was about covering up the truth of U.S. biological warfare in Korea.
That's right. And there's actually a really interesting account of the Frank Olson case in John Ronson's book, The Men Who Stare at Goats. John Ronson is not 100% on our side in all of these matters. He's kind of an anti-conspiracy theorist in certain respects, but he admits some dark truths, and this is one of them. And of course, the Frank Olson case wasn't just about LSD experiments. It was that Artichoke involved not just administering LSD to prisoners, but also torturing them to death as part of CIA mind control experiments. So Frank Olson was party to the murder by torture of, the total number was in the hundreds, apparently, of prisoners in Europe, especially Germany, by the CIA in its mind control program. And then he also was privy to these the use of plague and germ warfare agents in Korea. And he became very unhappy with this, and he wanted to go public with it. And so the CIA started dosing him with LSD and then ended up pushing him out of a window. So, yeah, you know, we get demonizations of other countries' leaders here all the time. But we have to realize that people in power here in the United States have been as demonic as anybody. And speaking of goofy leaders and nasty leaders and leaders who shouldn't be leaders, how about Trump? Yeah, here he is telling us that a big 9/11 style terror attack could save him politically. Wow.
Learning what we learned about how strongly committed he was to trying to get Giuliani into his administration, This does not surprise me.
And so who is this Trump? Is he really the great white hope that the white nationalists seem to think? I don't know. Next slide, we had an interesting article here from Ann Irfan on Trump as a kosher Nostra tool. And we've worked on this beat at Veterans Today a bit as well. This article is kind of all over the map, and some of it is connecting dots that maybe don't all connect perfectly, but there's a lot of interesting information in here that should be followed up on and should be more widely known.
Yes, and this idea of room 233, I think it is, at the Trump Tower Plaza that was apparently run by Roy Cohn, Trump's mentor, really needs to be looked into, especially by the MAGA fans, the Trump people who say he was the lesser evil to Clinton, which in many cases I would agree with. And clearly there are some type of human trafficking and pedophile mop-ups going on. At the same time, MAGA folks have to deal very clearly with who Trump is and who his background networks are.
Okay, and here's another Trump scandal story. You see a lot of those in the mainstream, but we're trying to cover the interesting ones in a more interesting way. What's this story about Kushner and Wendy Murdoch, Jeremy?
It's very interesting. This is Rupert Murdoch's former wife, and who he's now supposedly going around telling people is a Chinese intelligence agent of some sort, and supposedly U.S. intelligence warned Jarvanka, as they're termed, about Wendy Dang Murdoch as a potential Chinese intelligence agent who was working to try to get a Trojan gift of some sort of a tower in the U.S. Arboretum, which if I remember, is very close to the Capitol, and there was suspicion that it was going to be used for some type of surveillance. But in a deeper way, I think this sort of exposes some of the Zionist networks in relationship to Chinese networks, and whether it's Shaul Eisenberg, go back and look at him, or the increasing cooperation between Israel and the China's Belt Road Initiative.
Well, it's spy versus spy out there. And the Israelis certainly hit way above their weight in terms of the size, population of that country. So let's move on to the Zionist madness of Zion category and all sorts of madness happening over in occupied Palestine. Here we have Ahed Tamimi, who's becoming the poster girl for the protests against occupation, getting the book thrown at her in prison.
Yes, and the picking on teenagers is not a good look.
No, it isn't. This is terrible PR. I mean, I thought, you know, the Zionists, you would think, are PR geniuses, considering what they've been able to get away with over the years. But they do these stupid things. I mean, if they didn't run the media, they'd be doomed overnight, pretty much. And then speaking of mistreating teenagers, how about this guy, this Musab Tamimi, who was killed by the IDF, and now the troops are writing obscene insults with Stars of David on his death notice? I mean, this is really not only evil, it's stupid.
It's wicked and ignorant and I mean this whole of Israel as the most ethical military in the world is not going to survive this type of thing of son of a bitch, slut dead after you've killed a teenager.
And Israel really is the
Disgusting.
world record holder for this killing kids and teenagers. And they shoot at demonstrations with live bullets on a regular basis. Just happens constantly, almost every day. And if you read these stories about these demonstrations, you discover this. You discover a whole new world in which there are nonviolent Palestinian demonstrations happening practically every day. We never hear about that. All we hear about is the suicide bombings and the terror attacks, but there's constantly this nonviolent Palestinian resistance, and sometimes it becomes a little violent with some rock throwing and things like that. And the Zionists just mow people down with their guns. And the international community, you know, here in the U.S., with Kent, when Kent State happened during the Vietnam era, we had National Guardsmen shooting at protesters, and this was a national scandal. But this happens all the time in Israel, and nobody hears about it.
And similarly to the way that we know of the idea of incitement and of agent provocateurs in the United States in terms of protests, whether it's the WTO protest in 1999, I believe it was, that was clearly provocateured, and then the cops came down on it. You can imagine that times 10 or 100 is going on in relationship to between Israel and Palestine in the occupied territories. And I would just remind people that the Shin Bet actually has a unit called Yamas, which is specifically works to infiltrate and to act as Palestinians.
And the people who read the Hebrew press over there often find really horrible things. And one example is in our next slide. There was an article in the Hebrew press saying it was okay to rape female detainees as long as the cameras are turned off first, which this is the sort of thing that, you know, if Palestinians were acting like that, it would be all over the front pages. But since it's in the Hebrew press, it's only the rare whistleblower who tells us about it.
I'm not going to hold my breath to see if Alex Jones covers this today, but this is in line very much with this supposedly intellectual approach by the more psychopathic aspects of the Israeli security, so-called elite, who believe that the Arab mind, it can only be spoken to in the language of violence and shame. And there is some evidence, some strong evidence actually, that this is where aspects of the Abu Ghraib and the larger US torture program in terms of the so-called war on terror came from.
Yeah, that's the book, The Arab Mind by Raphael Patai, was, according to Seymour Hersh, the Bible of the movement that led to Abu Ghraib. So it and I've actually I've read that book. It's interesting. It's worth a read. I mean, it's horrifying, but Raphael Patai was not a stupid man. In that particular book, I think his whole argument was wrong, not just morally, but also intellectually. But it's interesting stuff, and that inspired the neocons apparently to use sexual humiliation on a broad scale in Iraq, just as the Israelis have been using it forever in occupied Palestine. Well, Chris Rock has no problem with this stuff. He's apparently in love with Israel. Okay, what's that about? Is he into this kind of sexual brutality himself? I don't know that much about Chris Rock's work. I know there's some pretty horrifying stuff in some of the gangster hip hop. So maybe you can clue me in, Jeremy. You're from a generation that maybe knows more about this guy.
I imagine Chris Rock just likes his money, and he doesn't like being called an anti-Semite or something like that is probably the case, although it could be darker. And as we'll see in later stories, there are other comedians who Chris Rock is in the mix with, like Jerry Seinfeld, who
That's
are
the next
very,
slide.
Very maybe closer to aspects of Israeli propaganda. And so I think Chris Rock just sought his money. And again, this points to the importance of boycott, divestment, sanctions, making a strong linkage between the escalating occupying mentality of the American police forces in relationship to violence against against all Americans, but increasingly people of color, in relationship to the escalation of Israeli training in terms of occupation. And so here you have an article by Phil Giraldi, who's talking about a really interesting line of what's wrong with liberal Jews, progressive except for Palestine. And this is a known factor in the progressive community, especially amongst progressive Jews, where they're all for equal rights. But when it comes down to the ethnocentric or even supremacist country like Israel, then it's sort of hunkered down.
And it seems
Yeah.
So some Jewish leaders who were actually pretty good on Israel-Palestine overall still seem very resistant to facing the really dark truth about a lot of this stuff. You know, they'd really rather, like Rabbi Lerner, for example. I've had Rabbi Michael Lerner, the leading American progressive Jewish voice, on my radio show several times. He's contributed to two of my books. I like him, and I think he's a great guy. And if he were in charge of this issue, it would get solved very quickly. But it's really hard to get him to really go there and face the dark side of Zionism. And even with 9/11, it was like pulling teeth, getting him to submit a really good essay on 9/11 for my book. There seems to be a resistance in Jewish culture to really facing the dark side of some of this tribal supremacist, elites' actions.
Yes, and it's very clear that the progressives, except for Palestine, want to seek justice without facing the truth. And you're not going to get to justice if you don't face the truth, no matter how dark it is. And I think there is some aspects, maybe we'll discuss in later stories, of the tribalism mentality, of where there's a sense of this idea of shonda, which is a concept of a shame, a sort of a shameful act by a Jewish person in the public, is a really, really dangerous thing in the Jewish mentality. And this idea of, from history maybe, of like a Jewish elite who worked their way into maybe a more covert power modes, and then the lower level social Jewish diaspora begins to associate its own social standing with the where the elite stand. And so there's always a sort of a sense of, if we expose our own elite, then that's going to sort of come down on us too. And I'd say that this type of thing actually heads towards Shoah over and over again if Jewish people are not willing to go the full route with the truth.
Yeah, that split between ordinary Jewish people and the elite is an interesting issue. You know, when the revisionist type in the World War II historians are always talking about the 1933 headline, Judea declares war on Germany, trying to say, oh, the whole Jewish nation declared war on Germany in 33. Well, that's not true. American Jews actually were by and large in favor of Germany in World War I. They were sympathetic to Germany. It was only this tiny little transatlantic network that dragged the U.S. into World War I on behalf of Zionism. And so, you know, keeping that distinction, I think, is very important. And Alan Hart, I think, was on the right track with this. Alan Hart was very, very sympathetic to the Jewish people. And he also, I think, was, you know, he was sympathetic to the Palestinians as well. That's why he was close friends with leaders on both sides of this conflict. But as time went on, he saw how the hardline extreme Zionists, people like the folks in power now, Netanyahu, we're just not going to allow for any peace, any justice, any truth. And so he did move outside the mainstream on this issue, which freed him up to speak the truth about all sorts of things, including 9/11.
Yes, and just so casting back to that previous Giraldi story, there's one thing that I forgot in terms of the truth and the whole truth and getting compromised because of a sense of vulnerability is that Giraldi mentions that the leader in Jewish Voices for Peace, Rebecca Vilcomerson, is married to a security network guy at this major Talpiot started Israeli cybersecurity company. I think it's called Checkpoint. So then you have a major internal compromise for why Jewish Voices for Peace might not want to take the idea of boycott, divestment, sanctions into the realm of the high technology sector and boycotting the Talpiot program's negative influence on the entire world.
That's right. Well, I'll have Brendan O'Connell on the radio tonight on my live radio show, which is 8 p.m. to 10 p.m. Eastern. Yeah, I think Brendan's coming on in the second hour, I believe. Or no, he's in the first hour. Robert David Steele is the second hour, and of course, Brendan has done a lot of great work on the Talpiot program, so that should be an interesting show. Is there going to be a one-state solution, a two-state solution? It looks like Trump has helped kill the one-state or the two-state solution. So the only thing left is the one-state solution. Will it be a Jewish ethno-supremacist state with the Palestinians all ethnically cleansed, murdered, or expelled? Or will it be a state in which everybody can live side by side equally as friends and neighbors? That's really the question.
It's pretty obvious that the rational and ethical approach to this is some type of one state solution that is not ethnocentric or ethno-supremacist. And so that's why I would open the discussion for people to talk about a Zionism of conscience, where there is idea of a Jewish homeland without the idol worship of a Jewish state, which has clearly shown itself to be have genocidal potential implications, not only to the Palestinians, but to the aspects of the entire world.
Sounds good to me. And this whole question of Zionism then, you know, runs up against the so-called Jewish question, which was framed by people who were bigoted against Jewish people and believed that they were somehow Semitic because of the origins of the Hebrew language. This 19th century bizarre kind of racism really suffused a lot of discussions of the Jewish question in the 19th century. Today, it seems like this question is re-arising a bit in the work of people like Gilad Atzmon, people like Laurent Guyonneau, who we'll talk about next slide. And here we have an editor over at Russia Insider, Charles Bausman, putting out a very interesting article saying it's time to drop the Jew taboo, saying that the war on Russia is heavily, you know, massively overrepresented with people from Jewish backgrounds. And why would that be? I don't know. But it's an interesting article. What do you think, Jimmy?
Yeah, I think it is a very interesting article, and I appreciate the call for open discourse and to break through the taboos. It seems like anybody who's familiar with Bolshevik history understands the role of the overrepresented role of certain Jewish elements in that. And in this article, he makes the claim that seems to have some evidence behind it that aspects of the Russian Revolution were backed by Jewish elite networks coming out of the city of London and New York. At the same time, I think this editor, he doesn't quite understand the pervasiveness of Jewish power in terms of false gang, counter gangs. He sort of praises the alt-right for bringing up these issues, which is one thing, but I don't think he quite understands that yes, there's clearly a lot of Jewish neocons who are anti-Russia. I would call those the paleo neocons, like the Crystals and the Kagans. But there's a whole nother breed of Israel first neocons who are very friendly with Putin's Russia. And there's a whole nother group of Jewish oligarchs that are in the mix. And there's an increase of play of a right-wing religious extremism in the form of Chabad that are in the background between both Putin's networks and Trump's networks. So I would say, yes, let's drop the Jew taboo and talk about these issues. At the same time, let's escalate our political sophistication in terms of understanding dead ends intellectually in the and intellectual counter gangs.
Absolutely. Well, in the next slide, here's Lauren Guyonneau speaking with me. We're going to get this YouTube up and running real soon. I have to do a bunch of audio editing on it, but you can listen to the audio at my radio show page. Just go to truthjihad.com, click on the radio link and look around, and you'll probably find that. So Laurent Guyonneau's From Yahweh to Zion is 500 plus pages on this Jewish question, I think from a perspective that really is not an intellectual dead end. It opens up a lot of areas that have been closed off. I'm really excited about this book. And I know you've looked at it, Jeremy. So what do you think? Is this going to help kind of reopen this Jewish question in a way that actually gets us further intellectually and spiritually and morally and in our efforts at peacemaking?
Oh, I think so. I think there's a lot of fecundity intellectually here that there's clearly a sophistication. Guyonneau even introduces aspects of understanding the 20th century American false flags and assassinations in a way that basically almost no one before has really dealt with, in terms of the false flag also comes with a blackmail component to it. And when you introduce the Jewish power network into it, a lot of pieces come together, whether it's the JFK assassination, or the RFK assassination, or increasingly the Martin Luther King assassination too. But then the fact that Guyonneau is not afraid to go back and actually do a psychosocial history, but also approach the problem of theology all the way back into thinking about through the Old Testament, the Tanakh, and how is this a tribal God that doesn't set up a healthy social or historical dynamic. I think there's a lot of richness in that. And my sense in terms of my religious studies and my Jewish background is that there's a sense of that there's always a tendency to try to hunker down into a tribal approach to one's God. And the mystics, I'm even thinking of Paul Tillich's The Courage of Being, I think it's called, is the idea of the God beyond God is where the real religious mystics point to. And in a way, this is the God that's beyond the small and petty and sometimes psychopathic psychological aspects of the lower gods that have a tendency to be tribalistic. So I think there's a lot of richness here, Kevin, and I thank you for bringing it forth to the English-speaking world.
Well put, Jeremy. Thank you. And that I think the idea of the Godhead, which is what Christian mystics have called the real God, as opposed to the kind of image of God. All of us have our own image of God, and often to make an image, we have to imagine something, and it becomes all too human. Like the image of the Father on the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel, you know, pointing down at the Son he's creating magically without any female procreational help. You know, these kinds of images may be helpful for some people at some times, but they can also be dangerous. And the real God is definitely beyond our images and our symbols and our human understanding. And when God collapses into a representation of our own ego, whether it's the tribal ego or the individual ego, then you've got a problem, because we humans have ego problems, and we just magnify them when we project them onto God. So I think there's a lot there. We could go on like this for quite some time, but we'd better get moving here, because boy, we have so many stories and so little time. How about the next category? Cyber dystopia. Gordon Duff just put out this piece demonizing Google. I don't know if he has to demonize them. They're pretty demonic already. Yeah. Are they as bad as Gordon says, Jeremy?
It's possible, and people need to look into this in terms of the idea of Google Jigsaw. It sounds like right up ISIS's alley in terms of cutting people's heads off in a cyber way. But this really is, if you're thinking about artificial intelligence as the new super god, as some people in Silicon Valley are more and more openly saying, then Google is at the epicenter. And Gordon Duff makes a fairly compelling case that this fits right in, that there is a strong axis between Silicon Valley and Tel Aviv.
Indeed. And even worse, that there's an artificial intelligence project behind this that's going to create what will amount to the Antichrist. It'll be an AI ruler that totally dominates everybody. And I don't know, this maybe is it sounds like dystopian science fiction, but that's the way the world is looking more and more, it seems. So the Google
advanced AI gods from the 21st century combined with archaic conceptions of a psychopathic, jealous tribal gods is not a good combo.
Yeah, let's not program that one into our supercomputers. All right, and well, it's not just Google. And by the way, Google has banned Veterans Today. You can't find Veterans Today articles through Google anymore. Big fight going on there. We'll keep you updated. Moving on to Facebook, another kinder, gentler tyrant crushing human freedom. So now they've got this new plan to censor their news content. They say, you know, too many people spreading too many conspiracy theories on Facebook. We're going to tweak the algorithms so you can't share news stories so much anymore. So basically, it's only going to be cat videos and what I had for dinner last night.
Good. That's. I hope that Facebook turns out to be a very effective yellow pages or white pages of the 21st century, where you can go and find your high school friends and not the big player in terms of a psychometric and psychographical warfare that helps destroy countries' democracies.
So that might be good. So anyway, Facebook is hiring 20,000 people to censor posts. In the next story, we learn that.
That sounds bad.
Yeah, but if all these 20,000 people are doing is deleting everybody's political posts and just leaving the cat videos and the what I had for dinner posts, you know, at least that'll be the end of Facebook as an Orwellian social control tool. So as you said,
what do you want to bet, though, that the ADL is able to make sure that IDF propaganda gets through?
Yeah, they'll probably have like the cat videos will have subliminal soundtracks telling us that actually Israel is the only democracy in the Middle East and things like that. Next slide, more cyber dystopia. The Michael Rechtenwald case. This is Michael Rechtenwald is actually a socialist. He's a deplorable socialist. I think somebody should run for president under the deplorable socialist label. Wouldn't that be a great new party?
Great idea. I think that would have a lot.
Well, Michael Rechtenwald, I'll vote for you if you run as a deplorable socialist. He had this Facebook account where he was deplorable prof, and then his colleagues, his humorless, idiotic colleagues, caught him. And they took him seriously. They didn't realize he was sort of being somewhat ironic and kind of, you know, just doing an exercise. And so they just went after him as an evil alt-right racist.
I would just quickly point out that I think that this sort of approach to trying to trigger the snowflakes and the culture war approach or standing against PC as Jordan Peterson in Canada has done is not really the most powerful way through against intellectual you know, barriers. I would take the Tony Hall approach and go deep into the matters that are really important.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. Jordan Peterson, by the way, is going to be on my radio show before too long. That should be interesting.
All right.
Yeah. I get the feeling he's pretty frank and upfront. So it'll be interesting to see what he has to say about some of these things. Rechtenwald actually is a good guy. I mean, he's helps out with Citizens for Legitimate Government, CLG. Highly recommended alternative news source. A shout out to Lori and the people there. So he's basically a decent guy. But yeah, this is not the academic freedom case of the century, the way a Tony Hall case is, that's for sure. How about the sexting? At Twitter, they're tracking and storing dirty pictures, presumably for blackmail purposes. They've got hundreds of employees looking through all the pictures, looking for dirty pictures. Wow, I wonder how much they pay per hour.
Yeah, I wonder how much you get paid for sorting through dick pics. And are they actually making choices amongst dick pics? Is there some type of prejudice against certain forms of dick pics? I don't know. But yes, behind the behind this is a mass surveillance digital society that's based on pervasive invasion of people's private lives and of mass blackmail, as you pointed out.
Well, this could help solve the employment problem because, of course, automation is putting everybody out of a job. But now suddenly Facebook hiring 20,000 to help them censor the political posts and hundreds of people employed at Twitter now looking for dirty pictures. It looks like maybe we can find a way to put human beings back to work in this cyber dystopia.
One might hope, but I also imagine there's probably already dick bots that are readily available to, suss out the dicks.
You would think they could program AI to do that, but I don't know. Let's move on to Honduras. Let's get away from the cyber dystopia. It's too depressing. How about this fight over the Honduran election? It looks like we've got this kind of, all too common situation where a U.S. military-supported strongman in a U.S.-occupied banana republic has been defeated in an election, but he won't accept defeat. So as the vote count is almost finished, he calls off the vote count, which he's clearly losing. And lo and behold, when they resume the count 3 days later, he won. So Nasrallah actually won, it looks like, and the U.S.-supported banana republic dictator Hernandez lost. But Hernandez isn't admitting it, and people are in the streets.
This has looked very blatant. It's almost all counted, and basically, the winner, the lose, apparent loser would have had to got 100% of the rest of the votes. And while the neoliberals in America are obsessed with Russia placing $100,000 of ads on Facebook, meanwhile, there's aspects probably of high-level American elements who are basically just stealing foreign elections straight up.
And Honduras is a pretty occupied country, really. I mean, you're worried about democracy in Iran. I mean, compared to Honduras, Iran is the ultimate paragon of democracy and freedom. Honduras, has death squads. They've got U.S. military people training various Central American death squads. It's a nasty place. I've been there briefly. It'd be great if they could elect somebody and allow them to take power, who would steer that country on a more independent course. And this Nasrallah guy, he sounds pretty cool. So now there are two leaders on different continents named Nasrallah that I think are pretty cool.
The Monroe Doctrine is apparently, with the escalation of the American Empire, has really shown itself to have a very dark shadow side, especially in relationship to Central America and the backing of these of military juntas and Guatemala and Honduras, and we all know El Salvador and the CIA's involvement in Mexico and the drug war and all of that. So this we need truth again in the mix here so that maybe we can actually have some more neighborly relations.
But Jeremy, if you really look for truth, the real kernel of truth often turns out to be a conspiracy theory. At least that's what they call it, because they don't want to admit it's the truth. So they have to call it some names to discourage people from looking into the topic. Here's the latest popular psychology thing on conspiracy theories. It seems like we're getting these on a weekly basis here. This one wasn't so bad, though. Star Vartan wrote this, and this is an outlet called what, MNN. It's like a kind of an organic living, and it's aimed at people who are maybe a little bit sharper than the Fox News crowd. And she's very ambivalent. On the one hand, she says, I'm the kind of person who's open to new experiences, so I kind of am interested in these conspiracy theories. So she's looking at these bogus university studies trying to explain away the psychology of why crazy people believe these crazy conspiracy theories. And she's, not quite buying it.
This is, in terms of these articles go, the anti-conspiracy theory articles, this is less bad. Yes, I agree. And what you see in these articles is a pervasive lack of facts, historical facts that are ever there. But I would just point out this, even with like a theory so-called might be wrong, let's say flat Earth, there is this possibility of thinking about what the actually searching into it means in relationship to our intellectual integrity and sovereignty? How do we know what we know? Do we just trust the experts, or do we also engage with the fundamentals of how we know what we know? And then also that we're inherently social creatures. And for all of the sort of, you know, liberal elite who like to say, did you read the science? Science is not a journal. Science is a process of experimentation of how you learn things about the physical world. So that's just your social tendencies being covered up in a subconscious fashion.
Right. So these, when people throw out these theories, even flat earth, as you say, Jeremy, the best way to deal with that is not to call them names, but to remind yourself why that's not true. This is what the universities are supposed to be for, is teaching people how to think through these things critically. And so maybe up at the University of Lethbridge, they'll figure this out in the not too distant future. In any case, how about the next conspiracy theory story? George Soros he's got his own conspiracy theories about an anti-Soros conspiracy by conspiracy theorists. My head is spinning already.
Yes. I mean, it's interesting. Like it reminds me of this article that referenced Kissinger talking about how the Trump administration, it's the Jews versus the non-Jews. But in thinking back through the Russian Insider editor article, part of the revelation we have here is that it's Jews all around and different kinds of Jewish.
They're everywhere
on all sides here. I think some other people should get in the mix, be allowed to get in the mix. And of course, Soros is the Jewish billionaire who was probably the most publicly against the Iraq war. But you definitely see the Soros funding behind most of the anti 9/11 truth propaganda on the left. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah, go figure. I mean, if he really is for an open society, he should be supporting Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth and a lot of other groups. So, yeah, Gordon Duff over at Veterans Today, who we mentioned before telling us that Google is the devil, does not think that Soros is the devil. He thinks that the alt-right white nationalists who think Soros are the devil are, in fact, falling for a stupid conspiracy theory. He thinks Soros is actually on the right side of most of this. And if Soros is not for 9/11 truth, it's just because he doesn't think it'll work. So I don't know. I mean, I'll split the difference on people there, but I don't think Soros is the Antichrist. I'm not even sure Google is, but with Soros, I'm pretty sure he's not. I think he really believes this open society thing, and that's not 100% bad. I think it's actually and Israel hates him. If you read this article, you get to the hardcore Likudnik, the nasty Israelis. Absolutely hate Soros. And to my mind, and they're the ones who are snuggled up with Trump and some of these alt-right people. So I don't know. I think if anything, Soros might be at least as much of a good guy as a bad guy.
Yeah, but I think it's more like layers of Dante's Inferno in a way, and that okay. Soros is the archetypal globalist, and that he believes that he has the vision or the right to go and decide local politics with his billions of dollars that he earned by fleecing nations and their currencies. So yeah. I'd say neither nor. It reminds me of Winston Churchill trying to sort of herd the Jewish masses into Zionism away from Bolshevism. I say neither nor. I take the radical middle.
I'll give you that one. All right, last story for the day. Sometimes it's hard to tell fact from fiction these days, and here we have an article in The Guardian about conspiracy theory fiction. This was by an author who's just published a conspiracy theory book. And so these are his favorite 10 conspiracy theory fiction books. And I thought I would just mention some of mine. Thomas Pynchon's Bleeding Edge is fantastic. Right up there with it, if not better, is Vicky Alexander's Locus Amenus. This is the best truther novel yet, definitely. Tom Breidenbach's 9/11 is on an equally high literary plane, to say the least. It's brilliant, but it's more poetry than fiction. And some other worthwhile books here would be Richard Flanagan's The Unknown Terrorist. This is a brilliant takedown of the war on terror. And let's not forget John le Carré's The Little Drummer Girl. Ugh. Oh, yeah. That tells you how the Mossad runs rings around the European intelligence services, setting up Palestinians and basically creating the theater of terror. So those are my favorites, or among them. Oh, and I got to one more great conspiracy book is Mike Polachek's Johnny Moon, which I don't have because I lent it out and somebody else ran off with it. So there's my favorites. Jeremy, that should give people a lot of good stuff to read this week.
Yes, thank you for those recommendations. That urges me, who hasn't read fiction in maybe more than a decade, it gives me an urge to read some interesting fiction. So thank you, Dr. Barrett.
Okay, well, thank you, Jeremy. And we'll be back next week with more conspiracy fact, or at least as best we can suss it out. I'm Kevin Barrett with Jeremy Rothkuschel. Tony Hall sitting it out for now. See you all next week, God willing.
Bye.